Hey, we are going somewhere. I don't know where exactly, but we're hoping you are coming with us. Why not? What else do you have to do? I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, here with Paul R. Levine in the studio at Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. We're happy to have you with us. We hope you'll enjoy this program. We have two really interesting guests, Mickey Huff, who runs Project Censored out in California, Sonoma State College, and they've just published a new book, a new annual edition of a book that's been going on for, I believe, something like 14 or 15 years, Censored, 2014, from Seven Stories Press. Please check this out. It's really worth checking out. Mickey Huff wrote it with, or edited it with Andy Lee Roth and Project Censored. We'll hear more from him in a second. And then later in the program, we're going to be joined with my old boss, so to speak, the former editor of Ramparts Magazine and an editor at the Los Angeles Times, no less. Also an editor of Truth Dig. That's going to be fascinating. So stay with us here on PRN-FM, and just to get us in the mood, here's a little song about the media for your listening pleasure.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
27 stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Time is right, and
ratings
pressures.
News goop, what we need to know. News goop, what we want to know. We got news goop, what we think we know.
So here we are talking about media. People are always talking about media, often putting down media without really understanding its dynamics, why it is the way it is, and why we're in this sort of war for freedom from the press as well as freedom of the press. Mickey Huff is the head of the Project Censored organization out in California, in a noble the footprints of a and footprints of a noble tradition. Hi, Mickey. How are you?
Well, Danny, I'm great, man. Thanks so much for having us back on the program.
Absolutely. And this is, I think, the best version or best year ever for Censored 2014. Fearless speech in fateful times is the tagline of this book. Just for purposes of those in, among our listeners who don't know much about Project Censored, tell us a little bit about what the organization is, what you do, and why you do it.
Well, thanks, Danny. Project Censored was founded in 1976 by Dr. Carl Jensen at Sonoma State University. It's part of the communications program there and went on for 20 years, was taken over by Dr. Peter Phillips in sociology. And in 2000, Project Censored came under control of something called the Media Freedom Foundation, a nonprofit organization. So Project Censored is not stationed at any one campus. We're under the nonprofit Media Freedom Foundation, and we work with students and professors at 20 or 30 different colleges and universities.
Wow.
Around the United States nowadays, including for this book, Project Censored, we reviewed and approved 233 news stories. We worked with 219 college students, 56 professors on 18 college campuses. And what we do is we review the most underreported or censored news stories that come from the independent press and alternative news media that are either not mentioned or covered in the corporate media, or when the subjects are addressed in the corporate media, they are lacking specific facts and they are often skewed in such ways that certain perceptions and interpretations are left behind. So we've been doing this for 37 years now, and we've been doing an annual book since 1993, and Seven Stories Press is our publisher there in New York City.
So let me ask you a question. All these years later, is the media worse or is it getting better? Is anyone reading what you're producing? I have the same question for myself. You know, I edit mediachannel.org. So this is not, you know, a passion and a concern that I'm a stranger to. But, you know, the media structures of power in America, the interests behind them are not always very responsive to questions or even the calls for reform.
No, not at all, Danny. And in fact, while the people's media and while grassroots and citizen journalism has significantly been on the uptake, particularly with the internet and nonprofits and so forth over the last decade plus, the corporate media, what masquerades propagandistically as the mainstream media, there's nothing mainstream about it. It's a mouthpiece for the plutocracy.
I think lamestream is a better phrase. I think that's John Stewart's phrase.
Mainstream?
No, that's Michelle Bachmann's.
Was that Michelle Bachmann?
And Palin, Sarah Palin.
Calling it the
lamestream
media.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, Sarah Palin.
Sorry, I take that back.
Yeah. At any rate, the corporate media has continued to get worse in terms of the public interest. They're doing a fantastic job for their shareholders. They're certainly benefiting the military-industrial complex. But the corporate media has actually gotten worse in terms of representing the public interest and really trying to tell people what's going on. And this year, in Censored 2014, we really comment. Some of our top stories are on Obama's war on whistleblowers, the Chelsea Manning case. You know, and the corporate media really just dropped the ball on those when they weren't outright persecutors of those trying to tell the public what's really going on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Richard Cohn, columnist for the Washington Post, you know, really took a whack at Snowden, you know, calling him, you know, questioning his legitimacy, his credibility, his motivations, his ideology, his bar mitzvah. I don't know what else there was to question about him. But now, surprisingly, Cohn has written a new column saying he was wrong.
Well, you rarely see a mea culpa like that coming from the corporate press, so it's certainly welcome. But, you know, these are a lot of Johnny-come-latelys. So while certainly one might laud the change of heart and under, you know, honest circumstances, I would at least limit the praise for such.
And Pilar, do you read the papers anymore? What's your take? Where do you get most of your news from?
The lamestream media and BBC, Al Jazeera, The New Yorker, just everybody I agree with that I know.
that's an increasing trend in the United States.
Yes, it is.
Only 5% of people under 30 read a newspaper. And, you know, if you take a look at the biggest demographic in terms of where young people go for news is The Daily Show and The Colbert Report.
Well,
so
that's probably good because they're both extremely critical and acid-filled when it comes to reporting on news coverage.
But they're actually reporting, and you're more likely to get some
background.
They're
reporting on the comedy network, and the underlying jab there is that there's nothing you can do about this, so you might as well laugh at your situation.
Well, you know, in a way there is something, because I didn't mention one of the places that I get, I don't get news, but I check out pretty regularly is Fox News. Because I want to find out how the other side is framing reality. And I think it's important for everybody to know what the other side, even the most extreme other side, is up to. And I don't mean by that the mission that MSNBC is on, which is basically to report on the right wing as opposed to report on the left wing or anybody else. They're just basically a megaphone for the right wing.
I think a megaphone for the Democratic Party would be more accurate when you speak of MSNBC.
Indeed.
But what I'm getting at, though, I thought you made a comment before, Mickey. I don't want to let it fly by in the ether, which is, you know, about The Daily Show. Because The Daily Show can be extremely brilliant in the way it takes news apart, but it seems to flow out of an attitude. You know, we're much too cool to take any of this seriously kind of attitude, this kind of stance. We're above it all. Well, you know, this is all ridiculous. And it doesn't really encourage people to engage with the issues very much, in my view. Am I off here?
No, actually, Danny, it's interesting that you mention that because Andy Lee Roth and I write exactly about that problem in our introduction this year. We talk about fateful times.
Oh, is that where I stole it from? I'm sorry.
Well, I don't think you stole it. I'm sure you've been on to this game for a long time, and I think we just agree that we write about fateful times and cynicism. And we address this factor directly about how people, you know, sort of have this detached stance as if they're not affected by it or it doesn't matter and there's nothing they can do about it. And we strongly disagree. And we believe that the more informed people get, the more empowering it can be so that they can actually shape real change in society.
But it is also a commentary on our media system. That there's more truth on a comedy network than there is on a news network, by and large.
Yeah. I mean, it's very telling of our entire structure and how completely backwards that it is.
You know, for what it's worth, I should mention that since Jon Stewart got back from Jordan, or I think that's where he was, he's been spending a lot more time with serious stuff on the first of the three segments. And... No, there's been no place that explained what super PACs are about on a deeper level that I've seen than Colbert when he did his routine of forming his own super PAC and having I forget that guy's name. He's
the government lawyer.
And by this routine of setting up his own, he had the details of what super PACs entail and what they get away with really explained in detail.
You know, the other thing I saw on Jon Stewart, just, and I'd like your comment on this, Mickey, was, you know, he took on the question of the J.P. Morgan Chase, fines that have taken place. And he looked at how CNBC, the business channel, is covering it. And there was a critic on CNBC who was skewered by the other regulars on the channel for daring to suggest that Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase can do any wrong at all. And the whole argument they were making was, you know, you're blaming him for buying banks that the government forced him to buy.
Right.
And he did it only because the government, the big government, pressured him to do it. And he saved, in a way, the entire economy by buying up these failed properties. And then Stewart went back. He says, well, how is CNBC covering it at the time?
Yeah.
And he went back to the purchase of these banks. And what we saw were, you know, stories saying, oh, J.P. Morgan Chase is brilliant in doing this. They're getting these properties for a song. They're really thieves. They're making away with all this property for nothing. You know, in other words, and what it called to our attention is not just a lack of context, but a lack of memory, kind of the amnesia that the media sort of encourages. You know, where we don't remember what happened a few years back or what happened yesterday.
Well, Gore Vidal called us the United States of amnesia, and that's unfortunately one of our big problems. And it's also related to the issue we were just discussing on cynicism. And I just want to say as a disclaimer, I don't poo-poo Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert for what they do. They're brilliant at what they do. I think there's a great place for that in our society. But I also think that shouldn't be the substitute stand-in for a failed journalism or failed media system. And I think part that contributes to that is that cynicism that we discussed. And we've had a significant rise in opinion journalism over hard fact journalism over the last decade. MSNBC, believe it or not, leads the way with 85% of its airtime filled with opinion programming, more than Fox News, the only network of the major networks, including public broadcasting, that has slightly more fact-based reporting than not would be the PBS program, I believe. Or no, CNN is slightly better than MSNBC with a 54% to 46% on that front. But the other interesting thing is that 77% of Americans say that news organizations favor one side. 66% say news stories are inaccurate. 80% say news organizations are influenced by powerful people and organizations. So the public is kind of caught on to the chicanery of corporate news media. But here's the rub. They keep watching it in relatively large numbers, and there lacks an alternative to fill the void that the public can readily access. They can't seem to find it, even though it exists. It exists with this program. It exists with PRN. It exists with Project Censored. There are scores of wonderful organizations and independent journalistic outlets in the United States that can fill that void, but it's rough to break in to the airwaves because they're controlled by six major corporations with the help of Congress.
Yeah, I also like to speak to that point about cynicism. I mean, you said you work with over 200 students in investigating these news stories. Mm-hmm. And these kids devoted and invested a lot of time to this analysis. They really cared about it. They worked really hard to bring this information to the public. So I think there are a lot of young people getting bad rapped as not caring when, mm-hmm. in fact, they do care, but they often don't have the outlets to express their views. And so a 140-character tweet substitutes for more serious news and analysis.
You're exactly right, Danny, and the millennial generation itself is in the process of getting a really bad rap from the older generations, and it's unfortunate. One of our affiliate professors, Nolan Higdon, is working on a great piece on millennials we're going to publish later this month at projectcensored.org. But more to your point, the students we work with, they're brilliant. I mean, honestly, and I don't mean to be hyperbolic or emotional to appeal to
an audience.
Oh, okay,
you can be emotional. You can be emotional here, Mickey. Let's let it all hang out, okay?
Let it all. But I have to tell you, man, when I see the students light up, and when students come to our events and they come on the radio, I mean, it almost brings one to tears sometimes that some of these people are just so turned on by an issue or so lit up by something, and you could just really see their whole life veering into a different direction. And it's just amazing that there really is hope and there really is strength in the youth that really do want a better future. And I have to tell you, despite this cynicism that's really promoted a lot by the junk food news corporate media, there are a real serious contingent within the youth that really want to get involved, really care what's going on, and they want to be listened to, and they seek a platform to be treated seriously. And we try to help them have that at Project Censored.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that today the New York Times is reporting, that Time Warner Cable, after, dancing around for months and trying to jack up the amount of money they could pump out of Al Jazeera, have agreed to carry Al Jazeera on 10 million to 10 million more homes. You know, so part of the problem of people trying to do an alternative or offer, other perspectives like Al Jazeera is not that, who have the money to do it, by the way, okay, is that the mainstream companies won't give them access, won't let them break through to the viewers on the theory maybe that people will like it and watch it.
Well, they're gatekeepers and corporate gatekeepers at that. And, take a look. If you watch RT, and you're going to see someone like Abby Martin breaking the set, you're not going to see any of those stories in the U.S. corporate media. You take a look at Al Jazeera English or Al Jazeera print media, you have to go there to find Dar Jamal writing about the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico that has been going unabated for years. I mean, these are not perfect news outlets. There are no perfect ones. But it's a shame that in the United States, the land of the free press, so to speak, you have to turn to these kind of outlets to find out what's really going on, because you're not going to see it on the New York Times.
I was actually on the air on Al Jazeera globally, on Al Jazeera English, earlier this week, and I was debating this important media question, Mickey, which I know that you must have a very strong opinion on. Facebook's decision, apparently now since recanted, to allow videos of beheadings in their news feed, okay? Mm-hmm. And I was discussing this with somebody from the Huff Post, who was basically saying, well, this is really important because it brings something that we haven't been able to see before to public attention. It's uncensored news. We can see these beheadings, presumably, and agree with them or disagree with them and the like. And I felt like this is completely suggestion that judgment does not exist. Everything is everything else. If you want beheadings, give them beheadings.
It would be a great reality show, wouldn't it?
Well, it is, except the beheadings I'd like to see are of the talking heads, but that's another matter.
Yeah, the beheadings. You get to the point here, it's like, well, whose beheadings are we showing, and at what behest, or to what end?
Or what behest?
All of this really creeps more toward the appeal to emotion propaganda, that we see. As Khalil Bendib said, CNN likes to show the missiles take off, and Al Jazeera likes to show what happens when they land. You know, that's a different kind of perspective. But, you know, I really think we do need an uncensored kind of media. But like you said, Danny, that doesn't mean that there isn't news judgment. It's to say, however, that there needs to be a transparent process where there's some public oversight of who's making the decisions.
I mean, we're certainly
that's what we need to know.
We're certainly trying. We've revived mediachannel.org. We're trying to offer thoughtful articles about what's in the, you know, media channel. You know, when we started it, the whole idea was let's create a place where all the different organizations working on media issues can be part of it, and it can be an additional promotional platform for a concern about media issues. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found was that a lot of the organizations don't want to collaborate with each other, don't want to work together, prefer to compete with each other in a way. Mine is bigger than yours kind of attitude. And this is true on the left as it is on the right.
Yeah, I'm afraid you're sadly correct, Danny, but Project Censored is a collaborative organization. I mean, we're working with over 20 universities. We're teaming up with the Union for Democratic Communications to do a big conference November 1, 2, 3 in San Francisco at the University of San Francisco. The point is to change it. Keynotes by Danny Ellsberg and Davey D. We would love to work with you at Media Channel. We're very interested in collaborating.
Great.
We're working with Sarah Van Gelder at Yes Magazine. I'm working with the National Coalition Against Censorship and the Banned Books Week people at the American Library Association. I'm all over the place these days, Danny, and we're going to fix things.
Count me in.
That's how we're going to do it.
Count me in. And one of the things that I think is very significant in the new edition, including your tribute to the late Brian Murphy, who is a good friend of mine at Niagara University, who was a stalwart in this area of trying to promote media literacy and media criticism. But in the book this year, and I think this is something we want to call attention to, is you have a section on critical thinking, media literacy, and narratives of power. And you also have essays that really look at the financial core of the transnational capitalist class. Explain this all to us, please, while we're here, because I want people to read this. This is a really sensational new research and framed in a way that is really understandable.
Well, that's the key, Danny, is that we are a media literacy organization and an educational organization that calls attention to problems of censorship and propaganda. But what we want to do is give people the tools with which to think about these things, understand and deconstruct them on their own. As educators, we're not interested in telling people what to think. We're interested in trying to tell people how to think critically. Elliot Cohen has a great chapter called Digging Deeper, Politico Corporate Media Manipulation, Critical Thinking and Democracy. And he breaks it down into, you know, six steps about how do you think for yourself? What do you do? And he applies it to specific, you know, media cases. And he talks about a new age of citizen journalists. The controversial Professor James Tracy, he has a great chapter on conspiracy panics, talking about, you know, there really are real conspiracies, and then there are some that really are merely theoretical and speculative. And we need to talk sensibly, honestly, and factually about controversial matters that take place in our society. The great John Pilger has a very unfortunate tale to tell in Censorship That Dare Not Speak Its Name, The Strange Silencing of Liberal America, where he recounts the very sordid details of how he was censored by the left and liberal foundations in the United States with his great film, The War You Don't See, became The Film You Don't See, because he was stifled by the Lannan Foundation and others, you know. And we think that these are the kind of cases we got to call attention to. And I know that it's sensitive, and I know certainly we don't want to turn into left-wing circular firing squads, right? But we think at Project Censored, when we critique people, it's constructively. When we critique what's happening, we have an obligation to our mission to expose censorship and to promote media literacy. We just did a major expose on Alex Jones and the work of Alex Jones and why it's very problematic for people that research some of the same subjects. Likewise, in the book this year, John Pilger takes a look at the Lannan Foundation, Amy Goodman, and others. And look, that's not to say that you're not going to find any good reporting at places like InfoWars or any good reporting at Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! But there are facets of it that are fair game for criticism.
Yeah,
and this is how we're going to improve the media system. It's also how we show the public how you build trust with alternative news organizations on their track records. And the whole section on critical thinking this year is really dedicated to that end.
You know, this whole notion of independent journalism, you know, is a great idea, but often when you scratch at it's really dependent journalism, dependent on funding,
yes,
dependent on contributions and all the rest of it. And, you know, as somebody who's run an independent media company, you know, we you know, took some money from people who other people were very critical of, even though we knew that they never told us exactly what to do or not to do with that money. Nevertheless,
right,
there are people who you know, add up two and two and get five, you know, to make an argument, to make a case of,
right,
of who's selling out and who isn't. And there is this,
yeah,
you know, tendency of sort of bashing that goes on the left and has for many years. At the same time, information is very important, and having an accurate, trustworthy source of information is important. That's why I find Censored 2014 an incredibly useful volume to try to, you know, offer perspectives on stories that most people don't even think about or think, you know, could be censored. I mean, certainly the Manning, everybody on the left, certainly progressives, knew all about Bradley Manning, but did it really infiltrate into the mainstream media?
No, not unless it was talking about the transgendered issues or lumping Manning in with Snowden, like Time magazine did on their cover, where they equated Edward Snowden to terrorists and leakers to terrorists. So that's the typical kind of corporate media propaganda we can expect. One would think the Manning case would have generated immense attention. It's a major case and a clear-cut case, just as much so with, say, John Kiriakou of the CIA. When the person that comes forward and shows how the government is breaking the law and is committing atrocities, those perpetrating them do no time. Those that are messengers are shot, imprisoned, etc. And it's really, really part of our theme this year, why we laud those that are willing to speak fearless speech in fateful times. Daniel Ellsberg has a wonderful contribution to the book this year on civil courage. We start the book out actually with Foucault's free speech lectures from Berkeley 30 years ago, talking about, you know, what free speech really is and where the ideas came from and what it means. And what it means is speaking truth to power, fearlessly speaking the truth regardless of the consequences. And we laud and celebrate those people that do that at Project Censored.
But also, I think what you do that others don't do as well is offer A, diverse viewpoints, B, critical thinking and analysis that really scrutinizes people on the left as well as on the right, and offers case studies, documented case studies. And I think it's something that is extremely, you know, important. So Mickey Huff, Project Censored, congratulations. We admire you and we respect you, and we're so happy you could be with us today. The book again, Censored 2014, from Seven Stories Press, the top censored stories and media analysis of 2012 through 2013. Get it, check it out, read it. Ask your libraries at colleges to have that book in the library, and try to help get involved in this struggle for a free media in our country, because without it, our democracy is all but gone. Stay with us.
That's
for
right.
Robert Scheer, coming up next on News Dissector Radio Hour.
Thanks, Danny.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold when Wall Street stepped into the fold. Congress paid off workers.
Godfather holds rules every year at election time. Do-si-do with the kids in the schools telling lies and pantomime. Dispatched by the strings attached. Scratch backs in the back rooms with the hacks where the sun don't shine. Your lifeline hanging on the dollar sign.
Even the rhythm has got the blues. Turn on the news. You are shame. There's nothing in the air, nothing in the air, nothing on the bed.
Ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, mm-hmm. here with Paul R. Levine on Progressive Radio yep. Network, News and Dissector Radio.
That was another classic Bipolarity one.
There you go. That's
the third one today.
Let's give credit where credit is due. The fact that I have a gun being pointed at my head to make this announcement should not be noticed by anyone nor taken seriously. I'm so pleased today to invite onto the program a journalist who's meant a lot to me as an inspiration and as a leader in independent and journalism, as an investigative reporter, as the editor. When we first met at Ramparts Magazine back in the day, so to speak, and then as an editor for many years at the Los Angeles Times, now editing Truth Dig, I believe, which is a website of informed opinion and analysis. Robert Scheer, welcome, Bob.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy you could do this. You know, meaning to have you on. We're doing this program every week here on PRN-FM and trying to comment on, analyze, discuss what I've been writing about. I blog every day at Media Channel, at newsdissector.net and edit mediachannel.org, which is an attempt to try to look at the media critically in real time. But I'm also very taken with the recent discussion of J.P. Morgan Chase, which, of course, is a big powerhouse in this city and in the country, and the announcement that they'll be paying $13 billion in fines came as sort of a shock. At the same time, no one at J.P. Morgan Chase to date is going to jail or has been indicted for any criminal activity, although there are supposedly some criminal investigations. You've been following this. What's your take on it?
Yeah, first of all, let me explain that I am the editor of TruthDig.com. Yes. We've won the Webby 5 times for being a really good site. And you mentioned Ramparts. Well, TruthDig is like Ramparts on speed. You know, we have Chris Hedges, and on Monday 100,000 people came to read him. So the Internet is great if it's used in that way. And on the banking thing, I wrote a book called The Great American Stick-Up. Nation Books published it, and I think it lays it out pretty clearly. And the thing that's so interesting about Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, is this guy goes way back. He was involved with Citibank, with changing the rules, reversing Glass-Steagall, so that the commercial banks and the investment houses could merge. And the whole argument was this would be modernization. It was called the Financial Service Modernization Act, the Graham-Leach-Liley Act. And his whole argument, and he was right up there advocating this, was that, you know, this is the only way we can compete in the world, and we know what we're doing and so forth. And it opened the floodgates of greed. And then Clinton signed that one. He signed a year later when he was a lame duck president, nonetheless took the time to sign the Commodity Futures Modernization Act that said the trading and all of these derivatives cannot be regulated by any existing government agency or any existing laws. So it was a license to steal. And then Jamie Dimon forms the biggest too big to fail bank, takes over J.P. Morgan Chase. They add on Washington Mutual. They add on Bear Stearns. They claim they're forced to. They really weren't. The Fed underwrote the thing. He was on the Federal Reserve Board at that time when Timothy Geithner was head of the New York Fed. And this guy emerges not only at the top of the biggest bank by assets, but also very well placed in the Democratic Party, because he's one of those who helped Bill Clinton bring about triangulation. You know, why should these Wall Street guys just go Republicans? We Democrats can serve their interests just as splendidly. And Jamie Dimon was very close to Barack Obama. He was the guy back there in Chicago. They were buddies. And then Barack Obama took William Daley to be his chief of staff when Rahm Emanuel went back to run for mayor, and William Daley was the chief spokesperson for J.P. Morgan Chase in Washington and their big lobbying force.
But what happened him? Because it seemed as if in the last election he was making kind of noises supporting Republicans. Was there a split there or a conflict there?
There definitely was a split, because the very minor re-regulation. I mean, after all, you know, Cantwell from Washington, Senator Cantwell, and John McCain teamed up on a bill that I don't know why more progressives didn't get behind it, and said, let's just restore Glass-Steagall. John McCain. You know, let's just do that, you know, and that went nowhere. And so the Dodd-Frank reforms are very mild, and there's really been no effective attempt to break up the too-big-to-fail banks. And the problem there, of course, is if you're playing with federally insured deposits of ordinary people, you're not going to let the bank go under because, you know, the people, a lot of people get hurt when you have a run on the bank. And so they hold us captive, and they say, no, we got to bail them out. We can't let them go under. And what you're really doing is hedging the bets of these gamblers that are using other people's money. And, you know, as long as they were just investment houses and using their own money and playing their own games, and then, you know, you lose, you lose. But no, now we have to bail them out. And then nothing has changed on that. Nothing in Obama's. And yet his language about fat cats was enough to embarrass them. And nothing really has changed on the derivatives in any significant way. In fact, the Fed is bailing out the banks. It's a part of this J.P. Morgan story nobody has mentioned. J.P. Morgan had a lot of toxic assets on its book. And what the Fed is doing with that $85 billion a month purchase is taking a lot of this junk off the books of the banks, and then the Fed holds it. And so, and then that, in addition to giving them almost interest-free money to let them, and they finance the takeover of Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual. It's such a terrible deception and crap game, and the media goes along with it. It's really quite depressing.
I mean, I thought I was just mentioned earlier, John Stewart did a fairly interesting piece about, you know, CNBC basically, you know, talking about how Jamie Dimon was forced to take these banks, Washington Mutual, Bear Stearns, and
yeah.
that's first of all
a lie, definitely about, or a distortion about Washington Mutual. The evidence is quite clear. J.P. Morgan thought that was a great buy, and they were actively pursuing it. As far as Bear Stearns, they got it for next to nothing. I mean, I've interviewed top officials from Bear Stearns who feel they were sold down the river. They felt they could have been saved, and they weren't given the opportunity to save it. It was a sweetheart deal for J.P. Morgan. But also federal money facilitated it, interest-free money. They have bragged in their literature that these were good deals.
Well, they
are good deals because the worst part of their assets have been taken off their books by the Fed with this quantitative easing, a story that has gone totally unreported. We're spending over $1 trillion a year to take junk off the books of the banks. Who's making that decision? What stuff is being taken off? The banks benefit. What are they doing? Are they giving mortgage relief to beleaguered homeowners? Are they doing anything of the sort? No. So it's a very much unreported.
I mean,
it's been
reported. I mean, I read about it.
Yeah, but it's reported in a way most people really can't wrap their heads around it.
Let me just say something. You've been doing this a long time. This whole thing is designed so people can't wrap their head around it. Because first of all, if the mafia did it, they'd all be in jail. The whole thing of collateralized debt obligations, credit default.
If the mafia did it, we'd all have read about it.
Yeah,
right?
But I mean, Brooksley Bourne, for instance, the great heroine of this whole thing, pointed this out in real time with her concept release. That this was junk. That they should have never been allowed to do it. And the credit default swaps that backed the stuff up, they had no money behind them. They were not real insurance policies. So the whole thing was a scam from the beginning. And guys like Lawrence Summers, when he was Treasury Secretary, were testifying, no, this is great. This is modernization. They know what they're doing, and they're taking
the
risk.
Well, what do you make of Bill Clinton saying it was a big mistake, to go along with this Modernization Act? That was the biggest mistake
he
made.
He retracted.
He retracted the mistake or retracted the admission?
No, he retracted the statement. They got on his case, and then he backed off from it.
I see.
You know, Bill Clinton played a terrible, terrible role. I mean, he came in with the idea that we should be the party of Wall Street. You know why? They're not primitives. They're not against choice. You know, they're not for biblical interpretations and blah, blah, blah. They're modern. We have dinner with them. They're right down the street here. So, you know, why can't we play ball with them? And they did. And they brought him into the government in very visible ways. Look, Robert Rubin was the architect of this whole thing. They took him from Goldman Sachs. And then he goes back. Where does he go back? He goes back to work for Citigroup. the very bank that was made legal by the reversal of Glass-Steagall under his urging.
Isn't it interesting?
You know, come on, you can't make this stuff up. The guy makes $150 million going through the swinging door.
Can you make up the fact that Ted Cruz's wife is a Goldman Sachs executive and that Ted is on the Goldman Sachs health care plan?
Yeah, but well, see, those people are so obvious. We know what scumbags they are. Come on, let's not kid around. I mean, I'm talking about our friends, you know. I'm talking about the people you'd like to have dinner with. I'm talking about the people who talk a good game. And yet you look, how did this, you know what, there were 8 senators voted against the reversal of Glass-Steagall. 8. And the rest of them, Republican and Democrat, all went along. You know, I mean, it's incredible. They knew what they were doing. I covered it for the L.A. Times at that time. I was in Washington. I went and asked, do you know, guys know what you're passing? There were like very few people objected on any grounds at all. And they knew, but the money was so overwhelming, and for the Democrats, it seemed like a new lease on life. And, you know, so they threw the Ralph Naders overboard and, you know, said, we're going with this stuff. This is a new party. And they bear a tremendous responsibility for this. They never could have gotten it through without Bill Clinton.
You know, one you know, bit of silver lining, just so we don't get totally depressed here, is, yeah. you know, Jamie Dimon being that close to the government. I mean, it's nice to know that it's not only Goldman Sachs people that are part of government.
Yeah, well, you know, there are plenty of Goldman Sachs people, obviously.
There's nothing but, you know, but here's Jamie Dimon. They brought in somebody from J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, that's amusing, except when you think of the 40,000 people who lost their homes, you know, when you think of, you know, we wiped out, the Pew Research Center showed over 50% of African American net worth, what you accumulate, what your family accumulated in their entire lives, wiped out. 60% of Latino worth. The whole gains of the civil rights movement wiped out by this Ponzi scheme that these guys put out there. What happened to working families? What happened to the attacks on the middle class? And you go to a place like Riverside, California. You just go, I'm talking to you from U.S. University of Southern California. You go around this surrounding neighborhood and look at the people lost their homes and didn't get their jobs back and everything. This is a suffering of enormous proportions. And no, they haven't confronted it. And I say, and by the way, since we talk about J.P. Morgan Chase, they got about 6 or 7 major cases against them. First of all, one good thing I have to say for Eric Holder, he didn't cave yet on the criminal charge. And in Sacramento, the federal prosecutor is working up at least one criminal charge against the bank, if not Jamie Dimon, because there is a good criminal case, and it has nothing to do with Washington Mutual or Bear Stearns. It's strictly then you got the LIBOR case, the rate rigging case, and you got the case of the Ponzi scheme of Bernie Madoff. J.P. Morgan Chase was the bank that was dealing with them, and they knew what stuff was going on. Why didn't they inform anybody? That's another deal they're trying to cut right now. And, you know, the title of my column was Laughing All the Way to the Bank. Everybody thinks this is big money. You know, it's not big money to them. You know, it represents the $13 billion is, what, half of what profit they made last year? It's not going to, you know, their stock is very strong. Their stock has gone up 24% last year. So the banks are doing incredibly well. And so paying these fines is what they think is a normal cost of business.
It's a business.
You know, and until you start
cost of doing
them into
business.
Jail, they're not going to notice this.
So, you know, when where do you put Obama in all of this? Do you think that he was oblivious to all of this, or he was calculatedly part of it, in a sense?
I think Obama's opportunism defies my capacity to describe it. Frankly, I fell for Obama. I contributed more money than I could afford to his campaign at the time, the first time he ran. I listened and watched the tape of his speech at Cooper Union when he was a candidate. He nailed it. He said exactly how this whole thing happened. He talked about the reversal of sensible regulation. He talked about the power of the banks. This is when he was candidate the first time. And then he turns around and has Lawrence Summers come in and to be his advisor. You know, Lawrence Summers, the guy who had engineered this whole thing. Well, that's a duplicity on a level that I can't even comprehend.
His whole financial team was pretty sick.
He turns down campaign finance money, right? He turns down public funding. And we all say, oh, well, he has to do it. And what does he do? He gets more money from Wall Street than the Republicans do. And then he carries water for Wall Street. He follows the same policy that Paulson and Bush were doing. Let's save the banks and hope the banks will save everyone else. Well, the banks didn't save anyone else. And he throws all this money, and he brings Geithner in, who was the worst. He was the head of the New York Fed. He was the guy cooperating with the Bush administration on all this. You know, he was, and Jamie Dimon was on the board of the New York Fed. Their big buddies, and you know, and the door was always open, the Treasury to Jamie Dimon. And so Obama has actually been a much more effective water carrier for Wall Street than George W. Bush was. And it's something liberals don't want to admit, you know, they have a hard time figuring it out. But, you know, like I have in my book, I criticize Paul Krugman, who I have great admiration for. But even Krugman can't accept it wasn't Ronald Reagan. This was much more Bill Clinton. You know, it was much more the Democrats, because Reagan couldn't pull it off. He had the savings and loan crisis. He had big trouble. Everybody was watching him. What are you going to give to them now? People were hurting. And at the end of the Reagan administration, he had to pull back on his attempt
to deregulate. I just saw a figure of the Bill Clinton Foundation, something like $184 million in the bank. You know, a gigantic corporate enterprise run by somebody from McKinsey and Company. I mean, these... to them, you know, this ideology, corporate ideology, is not partisan. It's really bipartisan.
Well, you know what it is. It's careerism trumps everything. You know, they're back in the 60s. It's this idea you shouldn't sell out. Now everybody wants to figure out how to sell out. And there aren't enough opportunities, so you have a lot of disgruntled people. But, you know, basically we've lost the spirit of critical thinking. We've lost the ability to challenge, I mean, as a culture. And everybody wants to cut, and it goes into the privacy issue. Oh, yeah, hey, I have my fingerprint. Oh, yeah, follow my movements. Oh, yeah, you can report my location. Oh, yeah, you can give all this information to the government. We have Hitler or Stalin's wet dream here, you know.
I think this is why.
Everybody, you know, line up, yeah.
And this is why I think the Germans were so freaked out, because of the memory of the Stasi is not that, you know, old.
Oh, the Stasi was punk. Change compared to this. Are you
right.
Kidding me? You know, in the old days, I mean, I was in these totalitarian countries and everything, plenty of them. You know, okay, you had some guy outside, somebody following you. Maybe they could cut into your phone. But this kind of access to everything we do, every meeting, every contact, and then the massive computer power to be able to sort it and check your eyeballs against your fingerprints, and I mean, it's just incredible. And we do it cheerfully. Why? Because we drank the Kool-Aid, you know, consumer freedom, that's all we want. Where can I shop? Where can I buy the next toy? And the whole idea of why the founders put in a Fourth Amendment, why they protected our freedom, the restraint on power, it's all been lost. And so there's a mass scramble for the toys, and that's what the folks on Wall Street understand very well. They say, okay, you know, we'll just spread it out enough so that the intellectuals won't complain and the media won't complain. If you look back on the record on the approval of the deregulation of the American economy and the reversal of the New Deal, which is what happened under Bill Clinton, and you look at the reporting of the L.A. Times, the Wall Street Journal, and certainly the New York Times, they cheered it every inch of the way.
Well, you were there. I mean, it wasn't they. You were there. You were an editor of the L.A. Times.
I was never an editor. I don't know why you guys say that. I was a national reporter. Nobody ever trusted me to be an editor. I became a contributing editor when I was a columnist, and I had about as much power over there as about extending your show. You know,
was it possible to have a debate within the editorial? Precincts of the L.A. Times?
Well, first of all, in the big newspapers, they had favored the Telecommunications Act because, you know, that was deregulation that would benefit them, and they could hold television and radio stations and newspapers in the same market. So all the big corporations, Times, Mirror, Tribune, everybody wanted that. And they were drunk on deregulation, so everybody wanted that. And so then here came, well, let's deregulate Wall Street. Well, they are Wall Street. They're owned by Wall Street. They're monitored by Wall Street, you know. So that became the cause. And
I
documented very effectively in my book. If you guys haven't read it, I'll send you a copy.
Yeah, please do.
You know, seriously, you know, it's, in fact, what is it called? The Great American Stick-Up. And, you know, and
mine is called, Bob, the Crime of Our Time. You know, and it's about, you know, the no bank is too big to jail, not just to bail. But, you know, I think we share agreement on this. Where are you finding sources of optimism today? I mean, you're teaching students.
Oh, I have a lot of sources. Let me tell you why. First of all, California is a source of optimism. Why? Because the Kansas, the Texas example, which really began here in California under Reagan and was continued by Pete Wilson, you know, the immigrant bashing, the countercultural issues and all that crap, hasn't worked out. In fact, the Democratic Party is in control solidly in California because of the votes of people who were immigrants and the children of immigrants. And you know, the Pete Wilson's bashing of immigrants backfired. The Republicans are barely existent as a party. And as a result, Jerry Brown has been able to sign bills that are quite advanced for immigrants. He's also been able to sign bills raising the minimum wage. You know, he's passed bills that were thought unimaginable before, and the reason is he got a lot of unhappy people out there, including even some wealthy people. Two of the wealthiest counties in California voted to increase taxes with Prop 30 to pay more money for the schools, people in Silicon Valley and Marin County. Why? Because they know if you don't have public schools that work, you're going to have madness. You've got to have, you know, this whole country is based on the idea there's got to be something for regular people, right? We're not supposed to be, you know, a kingdom. So I think in California you're starting to see that, you know, these contradictions of the society, the disappearance of the middle class, the fact that most people are left out of the party, starts to have a backlash. And people, you know, can vote. And I noticed that even the Southern Baptist Conference, was a very good interview in the Wall Street Journal this week, where the head of the Southern Baptist, he said, we got to stop beating up on gays. We got to stop beating up on, you know, on the choice issue, you know, and we got to be pro-immigration because we're losing the youth. You know, and we don't have any chance of winning here. So I think, you know, there's a limit to the power of these gonoffs, and we have to fight back.
And Truthdig, just tell us a quick minute about how that publication is working out, how your website is
well,
happening.
You know, we have the same problem everyone else has. How are you going to pay for journalism? We're not aggregators. You know, we pay for every photograph, every article. We pay something. The big money on the internet, really the only money, it's not even made by the New York Times, which has massive readership. It's made by Google. It's made by, you know, people who can sell the ads, by Facebook. And they go to the big circulation of people who take other people's material. So it's not a great day for journalism. It's a great day, though, for people learning stuff. I mean, the internet is a great educational tool if they don't shut it down and don't distort it too much, because you can get original documents, you can read stuff from all over the world. And we have tremendous readership. You know, we get millions of people every month read us. As I say, it's Ramparts on Speed for me. You know, Chris Hedges had a great piece. He's in Truthdig every Monday, great piece on Monday, and there were 80,000 people that read it before the day was over. You know, and everybody steals our stuff all over the place, so I'm sure 10 million people had read his article around the world before the week was over. You know, so we're able to reach a lot of people. It's hard, you know, our readers support us somewhat. We have some advertising, although I noticed that Google doesn't advertise with us anymore. But, you know, we're trying, and there are some other examples. I think we have some other very good publications out there on the internet. I'm not bummed out, by the way. I'm having a more exciting time than I've ever had. I think, you know, you sit here and you write something, and you can really reach a lot of people if you got the goods.
If you got the goods. Robert Scheer, thank you so much for joining us, Bob. It was really, you were great. I made my interventions minimal because you were on a roll there. Thank you so much. I'm going to send you the...
And you're one of my heroes, so anytime you want, I'll come.
And I'll sending you the podcast of the show. That'll be on PRN's archives tomorrow. It'll be in my blog at newsdissector.net tomorrow morning, hopefully.
All right, so we could post it on Truthdig, right?
Please do. And I think let's find some ways to work with each other or support each other. I'd really appreciate that. Mediachannel.org is back in action, and I'd like to call your attention to that. We're going to go out now with a song. Polar, tell us what it is.
This is a song that was written for your film, I'm So In Debt We Trust, and by Audioplasm, which is Polarity One and Rubio. It's called I'm So Broke.
I'm So Broke. Go for it.
No dough, nothing to show. I'm all night, can't sleep right, my head's tight. Got my food, clothes, books, and it looks like there's holes in my shoes. What to do?